Welcome to the Social Science of War. This podcast is brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. We bring together scholars and practitioners to better understand warfare, the Army, and national security strategy. The views expressed in this episode do not represent the views of West Point or any agency of the U.S. government. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, I'm Alexander Chinchilla, an assistant professor at Texas A&M University, and I'll be your host for today's episode. Today, we'll be talking about an important topic, how technology is changing the future of modern land warfare. And I'm really excited to welcome on the podcast today three distinguished guests who are well-equipped to speak to this topic. Our first guest is Dr. Jack Watling. Dr. Watling is the Senior Research Fellow for Land Warfare at the Royal United Services Institute. So what he does there is Jack works closely with the British military on the development of concepts of operation, assessments of the future operating environment, and operational analysis of contemporary conflicts. He also spends more time in the field than almost anyone I know, having worked extensively in Ukraine, in Iraq, and further afield. So all of this field research has went to inform his new book, which is titled The Arms of the Future, Technology in Close Combat in the 21st Century. And that's going to be the book that we're talking about in today's episode. Jack, welcome on the show.
It's good to be back on the podcast.
Our next guest is General Robert Abrams. I'm just going to give you the highlights of his extensive biography that are relevant to what we're going to be talking about today. So he recently retired from active duty with over 39 years of service. As a four-star general for over 6 years, General Abrams most recently served as the commander of United Nations Command, USROK Combined Forces Command, and United States Forces Korea. Before that, he served as the commander of United States Army Forces Command, where he was responsible for over 229,000 active duty soldiers and providing training and readiness oversight of the U.S. Army National Guard and U.S. Army Reserve. An armored cavalryman, General Abrams has commanded at every level and led units in combat operations in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, and Afghanistan. He also commanded the Army's National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California. And his joint experience includes serving as a strategic war planner for the Chairman Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he also served as a senior military assistant to the 24th Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel. Welcome on the show today. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
Our final guest is Major Ryan Van Wee. He is a U.S. Army infantry officer and a former assistant professor in the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. He's written multiple articles on the war in Ukraine, and recently served as a company commander in Operation Atlantic Resolve in Europe in 2017. And he's actually just come back from a deployment where he was the operations officer of 1st Battalion, 8th Cavalry Regiment, deployed under Operation European Assure, Deter, and Reinforce. So I'm sure I'll have a lot of interesting insights at the tactical level for what is changing in land warfare. Ryan, thanks for being on the show with us today.
Thank you for having us on today.
So we'll have a conversation today about Jack's recent book, very brilliant book that's just come out about how technology is changing warfare. It's called The Arms of the Future. So Jack, you discuss a problem about how war is going to be different if we look towards 2035 than the wars that we're used to fighting. Could you tell us a little bit about that problem and what motivated you to write this book?
So when we look at warfare, we can divide it into periods, and often those periods are defined by the tools of war, by weapon systems and by technologies. And warfare doesn't develop in a linear fashion, right? So the difference in terms of command and control and battlefield tactics between the English Civil Wars and the Napoleonic Wars were actually quite similar until you got up to the divisional and corps level. But at the point where you started getting not just breech-loading rifles, but then smokeless powder as well, and a range of other technologies, the lethality and the range that individual soldiers and the accuracy that they could deploy fundamentally changed how infantry combat worked. And that led to different formation types, different enablement, different capacities. We saw another transition with the evolution of mechanized warfare, right? There's a tinkering and experimentation in the 1920s and 30s where people are trying to get their heads around how to use these tools. And then you see it come together in a set of concepts around 1936, which lead to mechanized combined arms warfare. And that has really been the dominant kind of warfare that has been practiced ever since. There's more technology that's been added, but fundamentally, the core concepts have remained fairly consistent. And what I argue in the book is that there are another grouping of technologies that have now entered the field. They are ubiquitous sensing, so the capacity to sense beyond line of sight, the ability to fuse that data and therefore not just have detections, but actually understand and analyze data returning from a wide area, and the ability to have processing on the platform that gives you cheap precision at scale. And when you put those technologies together, what you end up with is a situation in which some of the core concepts that defined mechanized warfare, the need to achieve surprise, the need to concentrate, and then the need to attack at tempo, become very difficult to achieve. Surprise is very difficult against ubiquitous sensing, against battlefield transparency. The side that is forced to concentrate first is probably the one that will suffer disproportionate attrition. And timing becomes much more important than tempo because you need to create the conditions to move safely. And those conditions will be opened for a period and then closed, because while you can project, your logistics can be struck in depth. And so the problem that a commander is going to need to solve in the future looks, to my mind, quite different to the problem that soldiers were trained to solve over the last 100 years. And the question is, what combined arms tactics, what combination of tools allow you to unlock that new problem set?
Fantastic. So is this something where we can really describe the character of war as being fundamentally changed? Because there's technology skeptics out there that say this is not going to really change fundamentally what we're looking at. General Abrams.
So I come at this as a practitioner. Jack, your academic credentials and your research is brilliant and a very holistic view historically of that. And I would align myself with your comments. But, you know, as a practitioner for almost 40 years, I grew up in a 60-70 sort of mindset, a frame of mind for war fighting. It was characterized because of the technology as a very linear battlefield. We had limited night vision capabilities. So deep, close, and rear. The bad guys were over there. The good guys were over here. We'll make contact at the front, right? That's how we thought. Very linear. You jump into the 80s, you know, the early 2000s. Now we're thinking, you know, and it's codified in our doctrine, right? We thought in depth, right? We thought about fighting in the depth of the battlefield. We had, you know, the emergence of night vision goggles, night vision capability on our combat systems. And there was no longer just the front, right? Everyone had to be combat capable. And if you look at the U.S. Army's experience, we went into Operation Iraqi Freedom thinking in that very 70s linear mentality about, hey, just we're only going to worry about the guys at the front. And we learned a really hard lesson early on in the war. Everybody remembers, well, the old guys like me remember, and I hope that we can resurface this idea of the 507th Maintenance Company. The 507th Maintenance Company was a general support missile repair company following along a Patriot missile battalion in the early days of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and they took a wrong turn and got into a hornet's nest. Right? We had several soldiers killed. Jessica Lynch was captured, and you know, it made front page news. The mantra in the Army, right, switched almost overnight about, hey, we're never going to have a 507th maintenance company. So it's this idea that the battlefield is all around us for a variety of reasons, technology being one of them, but it's just that the character of war changed as a result. And now we're in a time period, in my view, codified also in our doctrine, very forward thinking. It's multi-domain. And Jack's point about ubiquitous sensing, I'll just say, yes, I agree, but I don't think it's the silver bullet that everybody has been banking on. I think there's plenty of technology capable of defeating or certainly denying during periods of desire when we want to deny someone that access for that ubiquitous sensing. And that gets to a later question you're going to ask about, hey, what changes do we need to think about for organization? This is a reality. It's not that new, though. When I was growing up in the Army, if you could be seen, you could be hit. If you could be hit, you could be killed. That was circa 1978. So here we are in 2023. What I just said has taken on new meaning. Now you can be seen by this ubiquitous suite of sensors, and the battlefield is significantly much more lethal as a result.
I fully agree. Where I think this takes us is to a position where historically you have tried to minimize your signature. You have tried to be concealed. And by being concealed, you'd be survivable. My experience over the last couple of years is that concealment is fine so long as you're not doing anything. The second you do something, you are going to be detected. The question is, can the adversary actually determine what they've detected? Can they get eyes on? Can they confirm that it's not deception? And if they are able to do that, are they able to get the information to an effector quickly enough to be able to exploit that information? Or are they going to waste a very scarce precision munition coming after me when I have moved? In other words, the general is absolutely right. You can disrupt, deny, degrade the enemy's ability to make use of the picture that they're getting and the returns they get from their senses. But this is no longer a passive act where you're concealing. It is an active measure where you are deceiving the adversary and having to be very picky about when you try and deny some of these systems. Because if you illuminate a series of electronic warfare effects, you do two things. The first thing you do is you reveal their location because they're emitting, and therefore there is a limited period of time in which they can deliver that effect before they have to displace. But you also reveal to the adversary the capability to be able to disrupt their systems, and they will then start changing the software. So you will lose the capability until you update your software and regain it. And so you have to choose when you apply those effects. And then the question becomes, how do you exploit the disruption that you create or the ambiguity that you impose in the adversary's mind? So the command and control tools that you need to be able to understand that battlefield are very different. If you talk to a Ukrainian brigade commander today, they need to be able to read a electrospectral map of the battlefield in order to understand when and where to apply their assets. And if they can't read that EMS terrain, then the rate of attrition against their forces will be disproportionate. You know, that is a skill set that in most Western militaries has been held by technical specialists that are supporting elements. And now it is becoming necessary to embed that knowledge in across a combined arms formation. Otherwise, you don't have situational awareness as to the threats that are out there.
There's a logistical component to what Jack just said, because if you're shooting artillery at what you think is a high value set of targets, and you expend that 155 or 152 millimeter ammunition that you have a restricted supply rate on, or a controlled supply rate, and you end up pounding dirt because of spoofing on the other side or deception, those are rounds you're not going to get back. I think everyone knows this, right? There's a significant logistical constraint in supporting the UAF right now. So the point is, every round has to count. And the other point I'd want to say that Jack touched on and I wanted to talk about a little bit is this idea of deception, right? So we think about, in the U.S. Army anyway, we think about deception as military deception to get the opposing commander to be deceived and either making a decision that's wrong or deceiving them as to our intentions. I think there's a blend now between deception, camouflage, and survivability. They're all kind of garbled up together now, because, I mean, we've all seen the images, right? You know, if you move, as Jack said, right, if you've seen these suicide drones, you know, chasing after infantrymen trying to run away to get in their foxhole, or a tank trying to escape, it's a life or death situation every single moment of every day, especially for armored crewmen. So I think deception and camouflage, there's a blend. There's a localized deception that has to happen to increase survivability of the force in today's battlefield.
I think the problem that arises from that is that very often when you have slow changes in terms of new tech added into the military, you tend to just bolt it onto the previous capability, right? So if we look at our armored vehicles today, they have more and more armor packs, acoustic sensors, active protection systems. And all of that drains power, adds weight, adds cost, adds complexity. But you hit a point where some of these threat systems start imposing trade-offs in what you can actually bring forward. A good example that the Ukrainians suffer with is that in order to have enough battle space to set up false fighting positions and to be able to deceive so that you can't be analytically targeted, you need to spread companies across about 3 kilometers of frontage. But what that means is that a Ukrainian company commander today is having to control a span of battle space, just in terms of distance, that is equivalent to what a battalion commander historically would have had to deal with. But it's still a company, and they don't have any extra staff to do that. And they're not able to be a larger formation because then it would obviate the point of dispersion. And so the tools and the training that that company commander needs to be able to cohere and control their force is actually quite different to the skill sets that we have traditionally trained a company commander to execute. Now, we shouldn't focus overly on the specific challenges in Ukraine because there are tools and capabilities that they don't have and say that, you know, that's the blueprint. But that challenge of span of control and what tools you need at what echelon starts to be fundamentally shaped by things like the need to deceive for protection, which doesn't just bring with it a resource commitment. You need people to go and construct these false fighting positions, but it also starts to fundamentally change the geometry of the formation.
I think going off both Jack's interpretation and General Abrams, I'd agree with the direction of the kind of changing nature of warfare with the proliferation of sensors and the importance of Western armies incorporating that into our training. So at the Joint Multinational Readiness Center, the National Training Center out in the Mojave Desert, and some of the large-scale NATO exercises that we've participated in with our allies in the recent years, we are making concerted effort to get at the exact points that Jack and General Abrams were just making. Dispersion on the battlefield, how to remain dispersed when back and then quickly massing at a decisive point, incorporating some of those more high echelon capabilities that have typically resided at the core level and above, like EW and cyber and space, and pushing those down to the division and brigade echelons to allow more tactical decision makers to have those assets. And that's all part of the recent evolution of this technology and how it's being implemented at the tactical level.
As technology shifts, another thing that has to shift is mindset. How is it possible to create that shift in mindset that's needed to be able to operate new technology effectively?
Let me just make two observations for your listeners. I fully acknowledge that I am a digital immigrant. I am an old guy. I'm a boomer. So I get it. But there is a part of our challenge for creating adaptive, innovative units that can keep pace is the leaders have to be willing to be open-minded. And we are not generally like that because then we don't have as much control, right? You have to be willing to delegate, and it'll boil down to trust. And this is worth discussing for a brief moment to enable this technology, this leap ahead, before you can even think about implementing it and thinking about achieving any level of confidence in it. First and foremost, there has to be a level of trust inside formations to be able to enable this. I've said this many times publicly. I was lucky in my career, except for one instance. I never worked for a boss, and I never worked in a formation where I didn't trust my boss and I didn't trust my teammates around me. One time in 39 years. But as I went around the Army, I found that I was the exception, not the rule. Trust is fundamental. To fight in those dispersed formations and geographic dispersion, as Jack alludes to, hey, that requires trust. You have to trust that the person at the end of that tether is of one mind, right? That understands your intent, right? That will take appropriate action regardless of whether they hear from you or not. That requires trust. And we'll only be able to innovate and we'll only be able to ingest technology at the speed of trust, in my view.
I would wholly endorse that. And I think, you know, when you're talking about new technology, people often frame it as a silver bullet that solves all your problems. And it doesn't. It creates a whole load new set of headaches and issues of integration, gaps in training. You know, it doesn't do what you expect when you turn it on, whether that's because of climactic issues, the adversary, whatever. And if you don't have well-cohered teams of people who have confidence in each other, who are adaptive thinkers and can problem solve, then the technology will not save you. In fact, it will be a risk to you, especially if you're dependent upon it. You know, your adversary can game the way technology is applied and can use it against you if you are just dependent upon a technical system. It's your ability to adapt and play with how you use and leverage different technologies that makes you competitive in war. And so we shouldn't lose sight that war is a very violent human endeavor and that building robust teams comes first. The other thing to highlight is that when Heinz Guderian was mapping out how the German army was going to do mechanized warfare before the Second World War, he had people running around in basically mesh basket tanks, you know, running with the platform, pretending to do armored tactics. When the US came up with air-land battle and started doing reforges in Germany, they didn't have Abrams or Apache at that point, but they started using the tactics from the concept anyway and built up a repertoire of solutions to the kinds of issues that that testing and experimentation showed would arise, so that when they got the equipment, they could execute and they had confidence in it. If you put the equipment first, then you have the wrong mindset and you're going to be disappointed. That's, I think, a very consistent rule. That's not new. But there is a risk that when we talk about technological change, people view it as making problems go away. And that's not what it does.
Yeah, we had some encouraging experiences in Europe during our recent rotation there. So doing some multinational collective exercises in Lithuania and Finland, and commanders at Echelon being willing to underwrite risk and allow us to kind of explore new operational concepts within this multi-domain framework. It was a great opportunity for us to experiment and attempt different tactical approaches that probably we wouldn't have done 5 years ago, but kind of willingness to accept that experimentation was a really important part of our rotation. And we learned a lot of lessons as a battalion and a brigade here in the Blackjack Brigade. So I completely agree with the importance of trust underpinning the development of those new operational concepts as we employ the new emerging technology.
Ryan, are you in a position to tell us a little bit more about what some of those lessons learned are? Like, what are these new operational concepts and what needs to change?
Sure. So in 2016, I led my mech infantry company through a rotation at the National Training Center in the Mojave Desert. And over this last year, we were in Europe for a rotation and we took our combined arms battalion to Finland for Operation Zero and Lock. And so we were in Finland for a couple months training with our Finnish allies and also some of our allies from the UK and the Baltics. And during those experiences in Finland, we definitely learned the differences in terrain and how the concepts that, you know, we typically employ out in the Mojave Desert are very different in the forests of Finland, and how the constraining effects of those forests and all the water crossings in Finland make it a lot harder to maneuver those mechanized formations. And going back to the earlier point about dispersion, when you are limited to only a few avenues of approach, you have to rely a lot more on deception and concealment and camouflage and everything we talked at the first question this episode. That was of the utmost importance to our survivability on the battlefield. So the first operation that we did, Operation Arrow, we learned a lot of hard lessons as a battalion. And we had some pretty significant attrition during each battle. But being willing to kind of adapt and learn and have critical AARs after each fight and then apply those lessons, by the time we went to Operation Lock, the second exercise, we were much better as a combined arms team. And on top of that, being able to incorporate our Finnish allies. So that was, you know, another very important part of our rotation and working together as a multinational team.
I just add on top of that, having spent quite a lot of time working with the Finns, including when I was doing research for the book, it's really important when we are looking at acquisition to understand where the answer is a new capability and where the answer is an old capability. And when it's an old capability, the objective is to drive down cost as much as possible so that you have as much of it as possible. You know, it's about the balance between the exquisite and the simplistic. A really good example of this, I think, is bridging. There are lots of companies and they will try and market to you their latest rapid bridging system. And what they're doing is usually shaving seconds off the emplacement time. But if that increases the cost of the platform that deploys that bridge by X amount, such that I don't have nearly enough bridges, then that is not the solution, right? Because the increase in survivability is insufficient. What you need is a very significant volume of bridging equipment. And in order to get that depth of bridging equipment so that you can afford either losing it or establishing multiple crossings, even though you're not going to use most of them, then you need to drive down costs. Therefore, simplicity is the critical thing, and you're better off going for something pretty old and tested and reliable. And we need to get pretty disciplined, I think, at understanding where we invest in the exquisite versus where we say we double down on what we have, because that is sufficient.
Alex, one of the questions that you posited for us was about choices, right? Moving forward for the next 10 to 15 years. And, you know, it's easy to say there's hard choices, Jack just touched on, you know, bridging and engineering equipment, but the list is pretty long, right? So electronic warfare, counter drone, shore red, deception or spoofing units, units specifically designed to perform that role. I think we ought to take a hard look at what do we have now that maybe is no longer suited for combined arms warfare in this emergent 21st century. For the U.S. Army specifically, I think we need to have a rigorous discussion about choices in organizational design. I don't think we've had a rigorous enough discussion on this idea of moving towards, quote, division-centric organizations. That's not what we're seeing on the battlefield as being effective. Decentralizing is prevalent for success, not centralizing all things. So the combination of equipment and organizational structure is certainly something that needs to be discussed.
Yeah, I mean, the point about what you disinvest from and which elements of a combined arms force lose their relevance is, I think, something I address quite a lot in the book. And one of the examples I do use is aviation, you know, utility aviation still being fundamentally extremely useful, attack aviation being a useful tool, but becoming decreasingly survivable, and also a capability where the effect can be delivered at scale from loitering munitions and other capabilities. And therefore, trade-off in terms of cost, not necessarily justifying the continuation, not least because there isn't really at the moment a concept for how you increase survivability. So, you know, there are difficult decisions that have to be made in that sense. But I'd say you also have to be really disciplined about the trade-offs when people are trying to pitch you future tech. And there is a problem, a systemic problem, where people will brief you all of the upsides by combining everything that something could theoretically do, but they won't talk about any of the limitations of the technology in terms of what it can actually deliver. A really good example of this is FPVs, right? First-person view drones. The conversation around that in Ukraine at the moment, as though they can just replace artillery. As somebody who works in Ukraine a lot, the loss rate, maybe 20% of FPVs actually get through. You have no ability to decide when they're actually going to be usable because it's completely contingent on the EW environment. And the reason why they're prevalent is largely because of a shortage of artillery. But if forces could get artillery, then they would depend on that. So the issue isn't that FPVs are not useful. And I think I lay out in the book where I think they do have a significant place in the force. It's just that if you want the range and the reliability to be able to contest in the artillery battle reliably, competitively, then the price point per UAV comes up to something like 30 to 40K per platform. And if you're talking about ISR platforms, it comes up to about 120 to 180K per platform. And just mapping out the electronic components, the coding, the subsystems in terms of sensor payload and communications bits that are needed to make those airframes perform their tasks, you really don't get cheaper than that. So when people start saying, yeah, it's a simple FPV drone that costs $400, but, oh, it's enabled by AI and it can go and hunt guns in the deep and it can do this and that and fight in a complex EW environment, they are all of a sudden adding a whole series of capabilities into the equation without increasing the cost, the relative cost of the system and the complexity of employing it. And this is a real problem because there are a lot of snake oil salesmen essentially trying to pitch concepts where they don't acknowledge the inherent trade-offs that you need to factor in when you're thinking about future capability as well as disinvestment and investment with the current force.
Going back to General Abrams' point on what is the right echelon to keep those enablers and assets, we here in the 1st Cavalry Division at Fort Cavazos have participated in a pilot force structure experiment looking at the future armored division. And so instead of having armored reconnaissance squadrons at the brigade level, you know, now each brigade has an armored cavalry troop. And then there's a new division reconnaissance squadron, 1-7 Cavalry. And so as part of that experiment, there's also some experience looking at engineer assets and artillery and nesting those at higher echelons as well. But we had an armored cavalry troop when our brigade went to JMRC in Germany during our Europe rotation. And it was definitely a lot more challenging for us as a brigade to win the reconnaissance fight with just a troop instead of a squadron, going back to the general's point. And so not having those more expansive reconnaissance capabilities at lower echelons was a tactical challenge for us for sure.
So how do you actually adapt when you're thinking about the future armored division? Is the main battle tank dead? I promised that we were going to talk about this a little bit.
Depends what you mean by a main battle tank, right? General, I'll defer to you.
Well, look, this is not the first time that the world has asked this question. Is the day of the tank dead? Is it over? Every technological leap that has occurred, you know, everyone said, oh, yeah, that's it. We don't, you know, tanks are irrelevant, right? And they're pillboxes, they're death traps, et cetera, et cetera. So we've heard this before. And fundamentally, I think part of the discussion is because people don't understand. They've got a romantic view of what they think armored warfare is, vice what it needs to be. And the great thing about the tank is it can fulfill multiple roles based on the mission, based on the enemy, based on the troops available, based on the terrain that they're fighting, right? But fundamentally, it is about shock, mobility, firepower to close with and destroy the enemy while keeping the crew survivable. In a combined arms sense, though, you know, not only is it capable of doing what I just described as a rapid assault capability, but working with infantry, it provides rapid, high volume, protected firepower to enable infantry, dismounted infantry, to close with and destroy the enemy, whether that's a trench, whether it's a built up area, whether it's a defensive position or whatnot. And that's the whole premise behind a tank. So if we're suggesting that somehow we're not going to need that capability, we can argue about size and what gizmos are on it and what capability it has. But to enable right maneuver, you're still going to need that capability. And oh, by the way, some may be manned, some may be unmanned. That is certainly in the art of the possible. But to suggest that we no longer need that protective firepower and the mobility, I think is a bit short-sighted and lacks understanding on how to fight.
Yes, sir. I'd agree. And I'd agree with Jack's take on this in his book as well, that as we look to the Abrams X and kind of taking the size down from an 80-ton tank to a 60-ton tank, that we're heading in the right direction by making it lighter, faster, more maneuverable, especially when we think about the Europe theater or fighting in the Pacific, having the lighter weight assets there to get across some of the bridges. We were severely constrained in terms of where we could take our M1, A2, SEP-V3s in Europe on the bridges, and engineer assessments were critical, and the limited mobility that the 80-ton tank imposes is probably not sustainable going forward into the future. I think Jack had a similar take in his book.
Yeah, absolutely. When tanks show up, they are the problem for everyone else, right? And I think even when you see them being knocked out, they are often knocked out. The shaping effect that they have on the rest of the combined arms fight is underestimated. The other thing is, I think a lot of people can conceptualize, okay, you know, this infantry unit has an anti-tank missile, they can destroy a tank. And in films, tanks tend to show up in ones and twos. In real life, they tend to show up in rather larger numbers than that. And the speed at which they move, the volume of fire, you can't carry enough anti-tank missiles to be able to deliver those engagements in the time you have, frankly, unless you have had months to prepare defensive positions and you have some way of slowing them down. So mobile protected firepower is very much a part of the future of war. However, when we start talking about tank design, that's where there are priorities that have been at the heart of previous generations of tank, which I think are more questionable now. The fact that you can deliver precision effects at very considerable range means that you can go after the things that keep a tank formation on the road. So reducing the logistical footprint and tail of an armored formation is really critical if you want to maintain their ability to fight. Therefore, that goes back to the point about making them lighter. But the other issue is when we start looking at the effects of precision on armored vehicles, you can hit armor where it's weak quite reliably now. And so very often you can bypass a lot of the armor. And you won't necessarily destroy the platform, but you will immobilize it, you will knock out its sensors, you will cripple its ability to be an effective threat. And so if we start looking at it in terms of, okay, I accept that this platform is going to be defeated if dedicated systems go against it, and there is very little I can do because I have to have an exhaust, I have to have sensors, I have to have these things that can be engaged, then rather than trying to make the thing invincible, I'm going to focus on preserving the crew, and I'm going to focus on making sure that I am protected against the most ubiquitous weapon systems so that the adversary has to have dedicated capability to knock me out. That's where you start getting into the trade-off of this being a capability which is efficient to field. And whenever I ran the numbers, I came to 54 tons as basically the balance point between you getting less and less bang for your buck, or rather protection for your buck, as you go up from there. So if you talk to different armor manufacturers, they'll tell you a couple of tons left or right of that. But broadly speaking, that's the tipping point. And so what you do within that lighter package, noting that modern MBTs are somewhere between 72 and 85 tons, depending on variant, is a trade-off decision, fundamentally. But if you stick with the 85-ton behemoth that some forces are fielding at the moment, then you're not able to deceive, because the engineering support requirements mean that your maneuver is very, very predictable. And the tail can be attrited to a point where the tank is not able to move at tempo, and therefore impediments to its movement, like minefields, can be rapidly emplaced.
I'm in full agreement with Jack. But I think for the American audience listening to this, this is back to that whole topic of acquisition. We have to write better requirements to industry. I think industry is prepared to step up to the plate, Jack. But our requirements, the way we write requirements as the U.S. military, it's done at the lowest level in a capabilities development integration division at Post X. And who ultimately is deciding what the survivability requirements are? And I do have a lot of recent experience reading requirements documents. And to your point, you can't protect everything, and we have to be willing to accept risk. But that's actually, for the United States, that's actually a national level discussion we need to have about how much protection, because our mantra for 20 years was, hey, do whatever it takes to protect the troops. And so we did. And for the right reasons, right? It's an all-volunteer force. This is our blood and treasure. And we value every single person. But on large scale, you can't ask for something that is completely impenetrable, because when you do, that's when you get an M1A2 that weighs 80 tons. That's the bottom line. So that's another take. But the bigger point for us is about writing requirements. In my view, what I've suggested is we should take a clean sheet of paper on survivability requirements. Don't take what exists now and try to trim it to meet the 54-ton expectation. Start with a clean sheet.
I want to talk now about what Jack calls in the book, the cult of maneuver. So what is the cult of maneuver, and how do training and exercises need to shift to move past it?
So I can provide some tactical experience to kind of get this question out. And I kind of agree with Jack's take in the book. So during a combined arms battalion river crossing in Europe, you can imagine with the proliferation of sensors, getting the combat power across that water obstacle and stacking all those assets up before the bridge. And, you know, there's attrition of your bridging assets. So if you're down to a couple crossings for the whole battalion, you're putting 29 tanks and 29 Bradleys across those two gap crossing points, then the stacked up tanks and Bradleys on the far side are a huge, just linear target for enemy artillery. So going back to the point at the beginning of the conversation where dispersion is critical to survivability, when you do come together, I think it depends a lot on the terrain you're operating in. And if you are fighting in kind of the Eastern Europe forest, that it becomes much harder to effectively come together as a combined arms team in the traditional manner that we could kind of thought about in the last, you know, 30, 40 years. So doing new novel operational approaches are critical, and employing all the different domains in massing effects on that decisive point are absolutely an important part to survive and get some slice of the battalion across that gap crossing and seize the far side. So we learned a lot of really hard lessons as the battalion during our initial gap crossings compared to what we did later on. And the importance of just simple things like where we have enablers. So if a tank company has no infantry to clear forward and eliminate threats forward, if you don't have air defense assets to take out enemy UAS and attack helicopters, if you don't have embedded engineer assets that can conduct those in-stride breaches all at the company level, then that company's not going to get across. So going back to trade-offs and thinking about where enablers need to reside, I think I'd agree with the earlier comments that they need to be pushed to the lower levels when we're operating in a decisive action environment.
Let me just jump in here with two quick points. The first one is, I agree with Ryan, and I'd add one more thing. Responsive, accurate, indirect fire to enable all of that to occur, right? This idea of, quote, centralizing artillery at the division level. Well, who's going to provide that decisive, suppressive 155 fire on enemy positions directly affecting the breach? It's crazy to me to think that a battalion commander has organic indirect fire called mortars, but they're not capable of achieving the effects that are needed at the point of breach. Nothing at the brigade level, and we're going to centralize it at division level. That, to me, is insanity. But that's another topic. I think, Alex, to your point on training, and we've heard Ryan say this a couple of times, right? We tried out some ideas. They didn't work out so well. We had rigorous AERs. I think the focus has to be on, historically, training has turned into, you know, reinforcing people on what to think. You're going to be faced with this situation, so you do X, Y, Z, and achieve these results, right? Very sort of left, right, left. Teaching people, training people what to think. Western armies need to have a premium on training exercises designed to train people how to think about unexpected things that happen, how to think differently about countering ubiquitous sensors or whatever it is. The premium has to be on how to think. So I'm heartened to hear that Ryan's experience at the JMRC enabled and allowed that sort of, hey, let's try this out. Nope, we're going to learn from this. We're going to try something different next time, because they're now thinking about how to solve problems differently instead of someone trying to give them a cookbook and telling them to just follow the recipe.
I think when it comes to the cult of maneuver, as you put it, there is this tendency in militaries to say, look, we're maneuverists. We don't do positional warfare. We're not attritional. And you kind of hear this and say, you know, okay, what does that mean? And people say, well, it means that we look for the enemy weak points and we attack those. We avoid points of strength. We try and achieve surprise, et cetera, which is fine. But firstly, all warfare is attritional. The question is, you know, what's the relative rate of attrition? And you're trying to make it as lopsided as possible. You know, the whole point of maneuver in a lot of ways is to set up conditions such that the adversary is having a much worse time than you. The second point is that usually the adversary can read a map too. And as Ryan just highlighted, once you've done your engineering survey and the adversary knows how heavy your equipment is, you know how heavy it is, you know how many bridges you have, it's pretty easy to guess where they're going to get put in. And so the question as to whether or not those crossings get denied is not about whether you surprise the enemy when you look at a real problem. It's about whether you can find, before the enemy finds you, and strike their artillery so that they can't cover the crossing. That's what determines whether it works or not. Similarly, your adversary probably knows what your objective is. It's probably an urban area, and their defenses will be laid out to try and maximize the defense of that urban area. There are probably a limited number of GLOCs approaching that objective, and the adversary will probably deploy their forces in such a way that they are covered. And so the assumption that you can always achieve surprise is, I think, quite dangerous. It's hubristic. And if we think about the future battlefield, to my mind, the first thing you have to do is try and degrade the enemy senses, which is a very maneuverist fight in the sense that it's dispersed forces and they are hunting each other and they are having to move fast and they are having to not stay fixed, because both sides, when they have sensor dominance, are able to apply fires very effectively. But it's attritional. One side's sensors start to become scarce. And at the point where one side's sensors start to become scarce, either because they're having to pull them back or because they've lost many of them, that's where you can start creating the uncertainty and the ambiguity through shaping the cognitive judgment of the adversary to make them use assets in an inappropriate manner. And you start creating opportunities for maneuver. And there's a maneuverist period of operations, right? And then what you're trying to do is you're trying to set up the battlefield geometry in order to enable you to translate the tactical successes that you have generated initially through an attritional phase, then through a maneuverist phase, into operational success, which is seizing the objective. But recent history, and in fact, most history, shows that the objective is probably urban or another piece of decisive terrain, and the adversary has probably identified it. And so once you have created the conditions where it is disproportionately costly for the adversary to deny you access to the objective, then the question is, how do you take it? And all of a sudden, you're in a positional fight. You are needing to commit mass rapidly and have a decisive fight for a specific piece of terrain. And so what this leads me to in the book is a view that you need more specialization within units for these different tasks, because they each produce very, very different force laydowns, capability requirements, and command and control problem sets. Whereas our historic approach outside of wartime, we usually do specialize when we get into a war, but outside of wartime is we tend to produce general units, generally trained units to try and do all of these tasks. Not least because that is a much more economically efficient way of maintaining a force if you were trying to deploy bits of the force against multiple different problem sets in the competition space. But in that sense, I think we need to be able to play tunes on the concepts of positional warfare and maneuver warfare rather than dogmatically saying, this is what we do and we don't do that.
So a lot has to change. How do we know if we're doing enough, especially before you're actually fighting, God forbid, a peer adversary?
I'd say over the 10 years that I've been in combined arms battalions in my career, in the evolution that I've seen taking place, every time I go to a major training exercise, I'm continuously challenged. So from that first NTC rotation I mentioned back in 2016 to, you know, what I experienced in Europe at a JMRC in Finland, we are continuing to employ new capabilities and test units on how those capabilities impact the tactical fight. So I'm encouraged by my experience as a U.S. Army officer. I know we have shortcomings, like we discussed, with some of the fielding of new equipment at scale. But I think at the training centers that we have and some of the large-scale collective multinational exercises we're doing with our NATO allies in Europe, we were employing electronic warfare battalions in those fights, and we'd have instrumented playback after each battle period. We could watch and see at which point the enemy EW battalion picked up our formation and was able to pinpoint exactly where we were, which is, you know, something I never got to experience when I was at NTC back in 2016. But in 2023 in Europe, you know, we're doing that today with our allies in a multinational setting. So I think we're continuing to make progress. There's obviously work to be done and continuing to figure out what that right force structure is and how force employment changes with the new technologies. And I really encourage Jack's book, Army Leaders, who are interested in how this technology impacts the force and what future force structures might look like.
The challenge, though, becomes we don't live in a world of unlimited resources. It's certainly true for the British Army, who I've got the greatest respect for, but it's heartbreaking to watch it shrink to its current size. And now even more downward pressure. But we have the same challenge here, although on a different scale, Jack. But we have the same problem here in the United States Army. And it's compounded by a couple of things. So, you know, today I think we still have structure on the books for 482,000 on active duty, when in fact, because of recruiting challenges, we can only man about 450,000 of those spaces. And then I read today that the compromise for the National Defense Authorization Act is going to put the United States Army active duty at 445,000 people. So you're right. We have a tendency to try to economize, you know, during these time periods before we're in the big fight. And this only makes the complexity of the hard choices, you know, is going to be off the chart. Can we afford, with a 445 active duty force, can we really afford to have some exquisite capability resident? And you're going to argue, or some will argue, that, well, you can't afford not to. Okay, but everybody has to understand that comes at the expense of something else, right? So now this is going to happen. It has to, I think, at 445. We're going to have to inactivate fighting formations. Brigade combat teams are going to have to be inactivated to be able to get to the headspace and then create space for these capabilities that we need, that we desperately need.
I think one of the really interesting social behaviors that you see in militaries is the difference between their approach to risk outside of the fight versus their approach to risk in the fight. When you're in the fight and your commanding officer briefs their orders and explains the plan, everyone can probably see some pretty severe risks that that plan exposes bits of the force to, and they can also probably see some imperfections, right? Everyone hasn't had enough sleep. There are bits of the plan that have better worked out than others. There are some things that the J2, the intelligence picture is not entirely clear, and there are some uncertainties. And people will nonetheless move forward and with their best effort work to implement the plan. When it comes to acquisitions and modernization, every single time a decision is made, you end up with, firstly, everyone jumping to try and gold plate the solution. So trying to add more and more requirements, as General Abrams highlighted. And you also end up with all of the bits of the force that don't like the plan working very hard to prevent it from happening. And there are a lot of political ways in which you can prevent things from being done in a timely manner. And so those sorts of frictions inside the formation diminish as the threat, the appearance of the threat increases, because people suddenly realize that they need to make some changes. And I think at the moment there is a tipping point, both because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and because of the increasing expansion of the PLA in Indo-PACOM, where quite a lot of forces around NATO have started to cohere around an agreed plan. That's what the British Army's now done. They have a land operating concept, and they are preparing to implement it in a much more rigorous and disciplined way. Whereas what we've seen over the last few years is an inability to prioritize in a lot of cases, or just tacking between different concepts as different bits of the force kind of gain control over the right positions in order to be able to get resources moved to whatever it is that they think is important. And so I think we are getting into the right space to be able to move at pace in terms of making the necessary changes. But it is frustrating that there has had to be quite a prolonged period where I think significant resource, and in particular time, which is of course an unrecoverable resource, has been misallocated. And so we're getting into the right place, but it's been a painful process.
So one thing I wanted to talk a little bit about was some of the strategic implications that come out of your book, Jack. And one thing that stood out to me is that if you're doing this correctly and you're adapting to the ways that technology is changing warfare, it's going to require that overhaul that you talked about, not just in equipment, but structures, doctrines, training, and mindset. And we've talked a little bit about this, how structure and mindset, they have this intangible quality that might be difficult to just easily measure and stack up. So when we're thinking about looking at our potential adversaries and seeing how they are responding to this, and also trying to credibly signal that we are responding correctly in order to deter potential challenges, what are some of the difficulties that emerge in that? Is it harder now to effectively assess how adversaries could potentially do and to credibly signal that we're preparing correctly?
I mean, this was a challenge before this kicked off, right? So if you think about most NATO militaries, the core of a NATO military is its infantry, fundamentally. And then it's armored officers and personnel. But the combat arms are at the front. Then you have combat support, and then you have combat service support. And the naming of those capabilities into those categories tells you that we think core light infantry skills are the thing that everyone needs to understand and be able to do. And then the other elements enable them to get onto the vital ground and seize it. And that's kind of the mindset of the organization, right? Disproportionately, leaders are from combat arms. The Russians don't see light infantry as a capability. If I'm being brutally honest, the way that they think about warfare is that you know, a general has their artillery and they have their other organic enablers that they can use to isolate and shape the battlefield. And then they use those to create the conditions for infantry to occupy the ground that has then been probably run over by tanks. And they do count armored units, armor, cavalry, tanks. That is what they measure in terms of the combat power of a formation. The reason I highlight that is because prior to the war in Ukraine, we were putting a lot of effort into infantry training of Ukrainian units. And we were hoping that that would deter the Russians, that it would show them that the quality of the force was improving. And they didn't even see those symbols on the map, right? To them, these were hollow units with no capability because they didn't see armored units in sufficient numbers. And so there is this problem, which is that we can posture the force how we think it should fight and train for that. But the way that we message that force in terms of its capabilities to the adversary shouldn't be correlated to what we think is good. It should be correlated to what we think they believe will create problems for them, which means that the messaging what kind of training you push through on your information operations or you choose to use your strategic communications to emphasize needs to be intelligence driven, and it needs to have a cognitive effect on the adversary based on what we understand their concepts of operations to be. And so appreciating that the way you present the force versus the way that you train and fight are actually different is very, very important if we're going to get the deterrence piece right.
Yeah, I think Jack's book does a great job highlighting how while there are all these new technologies out there, it's the sensors that your enemy actually possesses and can effectively employ that matter. And you have to consider that in your own operational approach. So I think when we think about implications for the U.S. Army in the future, you have to think very differently about what's happening in the Indo-Pacific theater versus what's happening in Europe and how we differently structure the force in each theater. So I think there's some interesting lessons from Jack's book that kind of come from the different capabilities that each enemy might employ in the different theaters and how we go about addressing those.
So I don't disagree with either of you, but I'm a bit of a realist. And as I just said, for the United States Army, we're going to have an active force, looks like it'll be about 445 or maybe even 450,000. And so look, for you guys, I grew up in that Army, right, where we had a force. You know, I'm a Cold War, I served tours in a cavalry squadron on the East-West German border. So I know what we're talking about here. We're talking about a force that was optimized, organizationally optimized, trained, equipped, manned, et cetera, to fight the Soviet Union. And then we had another part of the Army that was optimized for the Pacific. And that was really Korea and other potential areas in the Pacific. And that's largely the Army I grew up in. And that's the, even with transformation, right? Force 21 redesign, et cetera, even after Desert Storm in 1991, you know, we drastically reduced the size of the Army. And then, you know, we saw digitization as the transformative thought that was going to change modern warfare. And now we're into the 2000s and we go to a war in Iraq and Afghanistan and we realize, hey, in a huge army, I mean, what I think at the top active duty was 560. I mean, we were huge and a large part of the Guard was mobilized, as was the reserves. What we found out, though, is that having different parts of the army organized differently did not enable interoperability, right? So a brigade would come in from Europe, differently organized than something from Fort Hood. And now we got a problem because that puzzle piece, even though it had the same name, didn't fit in the puzzle in Baghdad, for instance, because it lacked some and had other additional capability. So this is one of the premises behind modularity was, hey, what we need interoperable pieces. Right. We need all the infantry brigade combat teams to look the same. We need all the armor brigades to look the same so that it gives us strategic flexibility, right, to be able to go in either direction. So I don't disagree with your premise that we should look for optimizing our formations based on the theater requirements. I'm just not sure we can afford it. And this is going to have to be part of the hard discussions that need to be had by Army senior leaders on structure.
Absolutely. So on that hopeful note, I think it's time to start wrapping up. So I would ask you, gentlemen, to think a little bit about the implications for the two major audiences. This is the Social Science of War podcast. So we are interested in informing the tactical warfighter, but also generating ideas for new research for scholars of war like Jack and myself. So speaking to either or both of those two audiences, what would be some words of wisdom that you would impart?
I can start, Alex, and I just say for all the junior Army leaders out there who are kind of in this tactical domain, to go back to an earlier point in the discussion, just be innovative, be willing to take risks, be willing to have that trust. And as you are employing these new capabilities that will be coming out in the coming months and years, to think creatively, think about how it works in a multinational alliance setting. And with that trust and creativity, I think that's how we'll continue to refine the multi-domain operational concept that the Army has and be a combat credible force that's, you know, able to deter and, if necessary, defeat any potential adversaries.
Yeah, I'd like to take a different swing at your challenge or your ask, Alex. I align myself with Ryan on his comments, but I think in terms for researchers, I'd like to see some real thought on the role, on where we need to take information operations into the future as part of multi-domain operations. I said this on active duty because I was part of the problem. We're terrible at information operations, operating in the information space for a lot of reasons. We're risk averse as an American military. We're risk averse, you know, and this is peace and war. We're just terrible at it. We overly centralize. We fail to see the effects. Jack, that was a fascinating point you made that, you know, the Russians have put different value on different capabilities. So if you're not messaging in their language, you thought you were deterring. Yeah, they didn't even yawn at your points because it didn't mean anything to them, right? I'd like to see more research and discussion. And in that case, I'd like to see a playbook on how we can modernize our information operations in the information space to really maximize the capabilities that we have, especially in light of the ubiquitous nature of media. That's my thought.
As somebody who's professionally, you know, a researcher and focused on this issue, I think my reflection would be that RUSI is in a very privileged position because we are very, very close to the British military. And throughout the course of this book, I had the opportunity to work with many militaries around NATO and outside of NATO, the Israelis, the South Koreans, the Ukrainians, Swedes, Finns, you know, US, UK, France, Germany, etc., out on exercises, using equipment, testing it, both for exercises and operations, and kind of putting it through its paces. And I just reflect on how invaluable that was, you know, the forbearance of many people in uniform with me asking, okay, but can we do it this way or can we try that? It was remarkable. But what it meant was that you kind of saw all of the limitations and the trade-offs. And I think far too often when people are talking about the future of war, they lay out concepts where they don't articulate the quite difficult choices that are going to have to be made in how a new technology is actually applied, or the limitations and therefore the resilience that you need, the alternative capabilities that you need to manage the fact that something might not work 100% of the time. And so I would just advocate a much closer relationship between the user community and those who are working on future concepts and future capability. If you can't get these ideas out into the sandpit, then the risk is that you come up with things that cannot be executed and implemented. And that wastes a huge amount of resource, energy, and time. So yeah, bringing together complex skills, that's the critical thing for me. And if you're a researcher, try and get forward.
Thank you for listening to the Social Science of War podcast. This podcast was brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider subscribing, leave a rating and comment, and most importantly, please share the Social Science of War with others. One final note, what you heard in this episode does not represent the views of West Point or any other agency of the U.S. government.